Support for this podcast comes from Wise, a universal account for over 50 currencies. Wise is the only account you need to go global. Whether you're converting pesos to pounds or dollars to dong, Wise makes it easy to manage your money across borders. You always get the real exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees, helping you save on currency conversion wherever your money takes you. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com/world.
The war in Ukraine takes an interesting turn, a precise attack on an airbase in Russian-held territory.
They managed to hit close enough to munitions or fuel to cause those big secondary explosions, which implies to me a level of precision that's probably a little bit higher unless they got extremely lucky.
Also today, as the Middle East grapples with even hotter summers than usual, the region is coming to a realization
that climate change is not a future problem that needs to be set aside until we resolve more quote-unquote urgent issues.
It's a now problem. I'm Marco Werman, and in Sri Lanka, expensive food minus fuel equals no relief in sight. This woman says she has food at home, but no gas to cook it with. Many Sri Lankans are turning to a non-profit community kitchen. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World on a Wednesday. Thanks for being here. A Russian airbase in Crimea was bombed this week. Kyiv did not take responsibility. Still, Ukrainian officials celebrated the attack, an attack that marks a dramatic escalation in the 6 months-old war. Chris Doherty is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. He joins us from Washington. Chris, what do we know about Tuesday's strike? How bad was the damage?
We don't know very much. It's very difficult to say from the limited video and the limited images that we do have. I'd like to point out to the listeners that there is a non-zero probability this could have been an accident. But this is likely a Ukrainian attack. And based on what we've seen, it's probably fairly small. But it does seem to have damaged some of the Russian aircraft at this base on the west coast of Crimea.
Right. So Russian aircraft, anything else that got damaged?
We can assume that there's probably been some damage to the airbase itself, given the size of the secondary explosions that we saw. There's probably some damage to either the physical plant or some of the systems and equipment that make an airbase work, like fuel trucks or munitions loading vehicles, etc.
So the airbase that was attacked was pretty far behind Russian lines. And a big question since Russia first attacked Ukraine was how deep into Russian-occupied territory like Crimea could Ukraine strike? If this is in fact a Ukrainian attack, what does it signal in terms of Ukraine's long-range military capabilities?
So it really depends on what you think conducted this attack. It appears from basically what happened in the video that they managed to hit close enough to munitions or fuel to cause those big secondary explosions, which implies to me a level of precision that's probably a little bit higher unless they got extremely lucky. It would appear that this was a precise attack. My feeling is that it probably reflects the fact that there are special operations forces from Ukraine operating in places like Crimea. Even if they didn't conduct this attack directly, it's possible that they used their own drones so they could modify commercial drones and then fly it over and then drop explosives on these things. That's possible. It's been done before. That would probably be the easiest way for the Ukrainians to do this. And conducting it with drones would allow these SOF to then, or these special operations forces from Ukraine to then get away.
Well, as you said, Chris, there are precious few details that have been confirmed about this attack. A Ukrainian official did tell the Washington Post the attack was the work of Ukrainian special forces. The official was speaking on a condition of anonymity, though. Not to question the Washington Post, but how could this claim be verified?
I don't know. And that's what makes following this information using open source intelligence, which we are all doing, it's really, really difficult because you're being shown exactly what the people who recorded that information are wanting you to see. There is a huge battle of the narrative going on here between the Ukrainians and the Russians, and then also other interested observers, you know, NATO, the United States, everybody has got their own narrative that they want to have put forward.
But also, why doesn't Kyiv want to come right out and say, we did it? I mean, the show of force seems like something they'd want to trumpet loudly. What does that tell you?
It tells me that they want to maintain ambiguity about exactly what happened and exactly how they did it. Mm. It tells me that they want to cause the Russians to jump at shadows. Once you attack something once, people get jittery about being attacked in that way again. And if they're not exactly sure how they were attacked, they can get jittery in all sorts of different ways. And so I think what the Ukrainians are doing is trying to maximize the potential confusion reaction that the Russians might take to this attack.
So how would you describe the military setback for Russia from this attack, if it is a setback?
So if this base has had its operations suppressed or disrupted, that limits Russia's ability to conduct air operations in and around Kherson and the other parts of the southern front. And if they really actually destroyed these aircraft, that's a pretty significant setback for the Russian forces. And it depends on how many they would have destroyed. But given the size of the explosions and given the vulnerability of aircraft to ground explosions, chances are pretty good if those explosions happened in a concentrated area where there are a lot of aircraft that they could have damaged or even destroyed a significant number of aircraft. Thinking longer term, though, this demonstrates to Russia that Ukraine can reach out and strike its forces in places that Russia thought were probably a sanctuary before, which causes the Russians to reevaluate their defensive posture, their security protocols, where they base forces like this. Each thing you do to secure your aircraft and defend them limits their effectiveness in this fight.
At this point in the war, Chris, what is the military importance of Crimea?
Crimea is a huge Russian military base. Beyond just the massive Black Sea Fleet base in Sevastopol, there are numerous other military bases. And it's a critical connecting piece between the southern coast of Ukraine. A lot of the military position here, Ukraine is demonstrating an ability to threaten it in a way that I'm not sure the Russians fully anticipated. And if this kind of thing expands, the Russians may have to change their posture, either by adding a lot more defensive forces and taking a much more aggressive security posture, which has all of its own risks, or by pulling their forces further back.
Chris Doherty is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. He joined us from Washington. Thanks for your insight, Chris. Really good to speak.
Thank you so much.
New inflation numbers in the U.S. came out today, and good news, the pace of inflation overall is easing up. The bad news, food prices keep on rising. Our grocery bills are about 13% higher compared to last summer. In Sri Lanka, it's much worse. Add to that the scarcity of cooking gas there. It's just become really difficult for most Sri Lankans to make meals at home anymore. In Sri Lanka's capital city, Colombo, the world's Carolyn Beeler visited a nonprofit that's trying to fill the gap.
In a church basement transformed into a temporary kitchen, Moses Akash opens the gate to let in the line of people waiting for food. Visitors walk down a serving line staffed by volunteers dishing up rice and four types of curry. Moses Akash oversees it all. He's the director of the Voice for Voiceless Foundation. It serves some 300 meals a day at this location. We talk in his office.
This is our office. We just turn into a kitchen now, so you can see all that.
He waves with an apology to the pans of marinating jackfruit and bags of rice sitting on desks. They're really just improvising here.
This was not a planned project or anything. This was mainly for the crisis that we started on the 1st of June.
Before June, his nonprofit handed out bags of rice and milk powder to those in need. But by May, when Akash was handing out those dry rations, he started hearing stories like this one.
There was a single mother with a two-year-old child where we used to go and give dry rations. So when we spoke to her, she said, I've been having ripe jackfruit for the last 3 days because I had no way of cooking. So that is, where we realized that giving dry rations is not going to resolve this problem.
Sri Lanka defaulted on its debt in May and has run out of money to import enough basic necessities like cooking fuel. People switched to firewood, but now even that's hard to find, in Colombo at least.
There's a lot of families who are unable to cook.
The foundation has launched 12 community kitchens since June and now serves about 1,800 meals every weekday. Akash says there's no tradition of nonprofits serving free hot food to those in need in Sri Lanka. He thinks these community kitchens are the first of their kind. Downstairs, Basanti Hayrat is squeezed into a crowded row of chairs, feeding her three-year-old son rice and curry. She tells me she has food at home, but no cooking gas to prepare it with. She'll cook an evening meal over a wood fire, she says, but she's been getting lunch here every day since the community kitchen opened. Sitting nearby is Sunita Ehinge, who says this is the first time she's needed a place like this to find food. She tells me she works as a maid and makes about $6 a day. But with inflation, that's only enough now for one daily meal for her and her husband. Skipping meals has become increasingly common here. Bismarck Swangain is with the United Nations Children's Fund in Sri Lanka.
According to a UNICEF assessment that we did recently, 7 out of 10 families reported that they were already cutting down on food consumption.
This is impacting kids especially hard. Sri Lankan schools have stopped offering free lunch for students. That increases the risk of them going hungry and reduces the incentive for them to go to school. UNICEF is raising funds to treat 56,000 kids for malnutrition and estimates half the children in Sri Lanka need some sort of humanitarian assistance. These are rates, Bismarck says, are common in conflict zones.
We are seeing a crisis like no any other, in the sense that here you have Sri Lanka, you know, a progressive, stable country. But unfortunately, we are having to talk about more or less the same type of issues that you would talk about in a conflict country.
Even at the community kitchen, the lack of basic necessities in Sri Lanka is visible. Volunteer Irani Kalua Devage sautés a pan of veggie curry up on the roof as smoke curls around her face.
So you're cooking over wood?
Sri Lanka doesn't have any gas, she says. Moses Akash says they plan to run the community kitchen until at least October, and then they'll see how the country's doing and whether things are looking up yet. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler in Colombo.
We learned this week of a monumental loss to the Nigerian and global film industry. Novelist, playwright, and filmmaker B. Bandele died at the age of 54. The cause of death was not given by his family. Bandele is best known for directing Half of a Yellow Sun, based on the novel by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, a family drama set in 1960s Nigeria during the Biafran War.
What's happened? There's been a coup. Right.
What's happening in Lagos?
This is the beginning.
Bandele was born during that war in a small town in northern Nigeria. In a talk to Portland Community College a few years ago, Bandele said his earliest writing began with a less than noble start.
I started writing stories, essentially copying and plagiarizing the writers I loved.
But then Bandele started writing about his town, Kafanchan.
Kafanchan was a railway town. My dad was a soldier during the Second World War. He fought for the British. After he left the army, he did what his dad had done, which was to join the railways. And so I was what they called a railway kid. I spent a lot of my time in the train station. You know, I knew from a very, very early age who the thieves were, who the pickpockets were, because I could see.
Bandele's first short story, he wrote it when he was 12, was called The Pickpocket. He left Nigeria for the UK in his early 20s, but he never stopped writing about Nigeria and his experiences growing up with civil war, military dictatorship, and corruption. A decade ago, he told Al Jazeera he didn't grow up politicized, just a kid from a middle-class home who changed after graduating university.
When the economic and political system in Nigeria began to go to the dogs, I began to read books on our history. I was trying to understand why things just didn't seem to work at all.
Bandele also got inspiration from his parents. When his father returned from World War II, he was a broken man. Bandele wrote about his dad's struggles, waking up in the middle of the night, screaming, having to be restrained by his neighbors. In 2007, Bandele turned his father's struggles into a novel called Burma Boy. He was also drawn to the narrative medium of film. His most recent movie, Edison Oba, The King's Horseman, will premiere at the Toronto Film Festival next month, the first film in the Yoruba language ever featured there. The film's executive producer, Mo Odubu, spoke to Arise News Nigeria last night about the film and the passing of B. Bandele.
It's a true gift that B, it's a legacy project. You know, we sent it to the Toronto International Film Festival and we were all planning to go. I mean, B, we've been talking about taking this trip. And yeah, here we are.
Nigerian filmmaker, novelist, and playwright, B. Bandele. He was 54. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Monkeypox continues to spread across the U.S. and parts of the globe. In the U.S. and Europe, the disease has largely been impacting gay men. The World Health Organization reports that 97% of cases are among men who have sex with men, at least according to the data scientists have about people who report their sexual orientation. But pointing that out is tricky. There is a legitimate fear of stigmatizing the gay community. Just go back to the early years of HIV/AIDS. So how exactly should we talk about the spread of monkeypox? Kai Kupferschmidt has some ideas on this. He's a journalist with Science Magazine, as well as a molecular biologist. He joins us from Berlin. Kai, let's start with the basics. How and why is monkeypox being spread so rapidly in the gay communities across the US and Europe?
What most researchers think happened is that this virus just came into this group of people. You know, a virus essentially can infect anyone, of course, but once it has infected someone in this group, it seems that the contacts between people, so what we call the sexual networks, are just structured in a way that amongst men who have sex with men, there is a very high chance for the virus to spread. So they're particularly vulnerable to a virus like this. So this virus, because it's not a human adapted virus, doesn't seem to spread so well. It's just that once it got into these sexual networks, it seems to have found a way of keeping going. And so this is why it is so important to also talk about what we can do at the moment.
So you've identified as a gay man, Kai, and have mentioned your frustration with the global health response to monkeypox. What exactly is the source of your frustration?
I think particularly in the beginning, but still to some extent now in a lot of places, there just was a hesitancy to really speak about the fact that men who have sex with men are the community that are most impacted by this. And I understand where that came from. For a lot of people, this was reminiscent of the early HIV days. It was, you know, there was the fear that this would lead to stigmatization. And I mean, we have seen that, right? I have heard from friends and seen on the news, there are instances where people have, you know, used this as a slur and have attacked people. So this does happen. But I think where people went wrong was that they thought, okay, if we keep the information a little bit more vague or more general, we'll still inform the public, but we'll be less stigmatizing.
So you're saying that by trying to be diplomatic, by not focusing on the gay community, officials have actually not done right by that community?
Essentially, yes. There's also the sense that for some people, it's just uncomfortable to speak about some of these issues. And I understand that. It is my opinion that it is the job of public health officials to do the work, to understand how they can talk about these things in a way that is not stigmatizing, to simply not talk about them for fear of either stigmatizing or even just for fear of being accused of stigmatizing people, is just not doing your job, right? You do need to engage, and that's work. But this is, you know, the point of public health is to meet people where they are in a non-judgmental way, in a compassionate way, and to give them the information that they need to stay safe in a way that they can accept this information and can trust you with that information.
Has monkeypox been a concern for men who have sex with men before this current surge? Like, how has it been discussed in the gay community up until now?
This is a disease that very few people in the global north have talked about at all. It's a disease that has caused suffering and death in certain countries in Central and West Africa for decades. We did know that the risk of monkeypox having a resurgence at some point was increasing, but it was never really seen as a disease that spreads through sexual contact. I mean, there are some indications now that maybe in Nigeria it did do that in recent years. But before that, it was generally a disease that, for instance, hunters would get from contact with wild animals and then maybe spread in their household.
So in your opinion, how exactly should officials, not to mention the public, strike a balance between warning about monkeypox and not further stigmatizing gay men?
It's like a lot of people talk about the community, but of course the crucial issue is to talk with the community and to make sure that you understand what the concerns are and how best to talk about it. I mean, on a very basic level, a little thing like saying this is spreading amongst men who have sex with men, rather than saying this is spread by men who have sex with men, which also isn't what happens. You know, these little things, they make a difference. We have to be fair and say that the COVID-19 pandemic that we've all been going through for more than 2 years, of course, you know, has left people exhausted. And so it is quite difficult in this situation now to have this new public health challenge, which again raises all of these questions and really demands a lot from people. But unfortunately, that is the world that we live in now.
Kai Kupferschmidt is a journalist with Science Magazine, as well as a molecular biologist. He's been speaking with us from Berlin. Kai, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Rain is pummeling South Korea this week. In some places, it's falling faster than ever recorded in the country's history. At least 9 people are dead and more missing in flooding that has put parts of the capital, Seoul, underwater. Rescue workers have evacuated more than 500 people from the city, and many there are coping with downed power lines and electricity outages, including in the famously posh Gangnam neighborhood. The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following the story. This sounds really bad, Patrick. What is the latest from Seoul?
Yeah, the good news, Marco, is that rains eased up a bit today, allowing people to start picking up the pieces. But the bad news is that more heavy rains are coming tomorrow. And, you know, these floods have really produced some bizarre scenes. Roads just turned into raging rivers, people abandoning cars and swimming to safety. The modern subway system in Seoul is just filled up with brown water. And some of those killed lived in these basement apartments called Banjia. They're bunkers built decades ago in case of an invasion from North Korea, but because of Seoul's housing shortage, low-income people live in these underground cellars, and the family in the Oscar-winning movie Parasite lived in a banjia. And they're these dark underground places that are dangerous in floods because they quickly fill up with water and they've caused several deaths in Seoul.
Wow. South Korea has a new president, Yoon Suk-yeol. He took office in May. How's he handling all this?
President Yoon actually visited a banjia apartment where 3 people died. And during parts of this crisis, the president's own condo was partially flooded, so he had to make decisions from his living room because he couldn't even get out. He is out now. South Korean media and President Yoon are bringing up climate change a lot. Yoon is saying that South Korea needs to upgrade its disaster management policies, because under climate change, these freak weather events will probably keep happening. I should just reiterate, this is like a summer's worth of rain falling in a few days. It is very bizarre. And these downpours are expected to become more and more intense, according to the UN's panel on climate change. So Yoon is pointing that out. And I should point out that Yoon is a right-wing president. But unlike America, climate change isn't politicized as a left-right issue in South Korea. So he can bring up climate change without any fear of backlash.
Right. So the city of Seoul is not too far from the border with North Korea. What is the situation in the north with rain and flooding? Do we even know?
We do. North Korea is getting hammered by rain as well, especially in the southern part near South Korea. And a lot of farmland in North Korea appears to be deluged, which is bad because North Korea is suffering from a food shortage right now and they need all the food they can get. You know, Marco, the North Korea-South Korea tension has a way of seeping into all sorts of stories, and this one is no exception. There is a dam on the border, and it's controlled by North Korea, and it's built to help North Korea relieve itself from flash floods. They're supposed to notify South Korea when they open it up, but instead they have been opening it up with no prior notice, throwing South Korea into disarray, releasing even more water into South Korea, catching people off guard, and possibly causing more added damage.
The UN climate experts say these storms will get worse, but right now a little relief, as you pointed out, in South Korea with the rains letting up. The World's Patrick Nguyen, thank you very much for the update.
Thanks, Marco.
You're with the world. We continue looking back at how wars end. Today, the conclusion of World War I and the harsh conditions imposed on a German nation by the Treaty of Versailles.
We have now come away from that saying, if we're in that situation in the future, we must recognize the aspirations of both sides. There needs to be a dialogue.
The long-term consequences of that truce ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. The Middle East and North Africa, already prone to hot summer temperatures, are dealing with months of off-the-chart heat. In Iraq, for example, the mercury has regularly been over 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Karim Elgendi knows a lot about this. He's a consultant on urban sustainability and climate. I asked him how the Middle East and North Africa are being impacted by climate change.
The impacts of climate change on the region are disproportionate, I would say. But overall, the impacts can be distributed to a number of basic biophysical impacts. An increase in temperature, both average temperature, but also extreme temperatures, so maximum temperatures.
How else is climate change impacting the Middle East, North Africa region? I'm thinking specifically about water.
So in the Levant, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and south of Turkey, we'll see a reduction in precipitation of up to 25% under the worst case scenario. But also in North Africa, we'll get even harsher reduction in precipitation, both rainfall and snowfall on the Atlas Mountains. So that includes Morocco and also parts of Algeria.
So putting climate change aside, Karim, the Middle East and North Africa region is facing a lot of issues. There's political instability, conflict, government oppression, food insecurity. I mean, I know it's hard to generalize with so many different countries, but with those elements present in so many places, how is the region as a whole facing the challenge of climate change and preparing for an even hotter future?
Well, the region is coming to a realization that climate change is not a future problem, but climate change is an additional set of challenges that is just exacerbating and compounding all these other challenges. When there is conflict, the basic infrastructure that is required for adapting to climate change, like the water networks, for example, are the first to suffer. As a result, many countries of the region, especially that have conflict or are under occupation, are often struggling because of that vicious cycle.
Are you seeing signs that the governments of the region are working together to find solutions?
Well, the governments have changed direction in the last couple of years. There is a significant interest in climate change issues. The UAE, I think, aims to decarbonize, to reach net zero carbon by 2050, Saudi Arabia by 2060. Many countries of the region have put conditional promises, conditional pledges under the Paris Agreement before they can take any action to mitigate or to adapt to climate change. And the reason that is the case is because they don't have the financial resources to do them.
Of course, a key part of GDP and wealth in many Mideast countries is oil. How is the region preparing itself to basically decarbonize and mitigate climate change while economies there are so reliant on fossil fuels? I mean, how do you square that circle?
The way carbon is accounted for, it's where it's burned. So an exporting country that exports 10 billion barrels of oil is not responsible for those in terms of the carbon emission.
Mm. And even though the money is flowing in, do those countries still see the problem that they are exporting this commodity that's causing climate change?
They are very aware of this. The world will need some oil and gas. Let's say 10% of the current oil and gas that is being consumed will be consumed in 2050 under the best case scenario. That oil and gas will come from someone. And in the minds of many of those producers, that someone is Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, etc.
If the globe does not get the problem under control, what do you think the MENA region will look like?
If we're looking at runaway climate change, where we get increases in average temperatures by 4 degrees or so, then we're looking at potentially uninhabitable parts of this region. The risks are really severe, not just for the MENA region, but the redistribution of human civilization around the world in a very different climate.
Karim El-Gendi is an urban sustainability and climate consultant. He's also an associate fellow at Chatham House and joined us from London. Karim, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This week, we've been tackling this question, how do wars end? It's something our newsroom took on 14 years ago in a series of stories looking back at past conflicts. With the upcoming one-year anniversary of the fall of Kabul and the ongoing fighting in Ukraine, understanding the end of war feels as relevant as ever. Today, we look back to World War I. Reporter Jeb Sharp has our story.
The Hall of Mirrors at the Palace of Versailles outside Paris is a gleaming, glittering place where the light ricochets off the mirrors and chandeliers. It was here on June 28, 1919, that world leaders sat down with German officials to sign the Treaty of Versailles. Historian Margaret Macmillan describes the scene in her book, Paris 1919.
It was a very formal ceremony, but at the end it was chaos. The world leaders, Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister, Woodrow Wilson, and the American President went out to that gorgeous terrace leading out to that great park, and the fountains went off. The huge number of people standing outside, and the crowd jostled everyone, and Woodrow Wilson lost his top hat, and Lloyd George was furious. So it was a mixture of ceremony and chaos.
A mixture, Macmillan says, that perhaps summed up the state of Europe at that moment. World War I had upended the old order.
It's an end and it's a beginning.
Hugh Strawn is professor of the history of war at Oxford University.
For Western Europe, it's an end to the idea that war is an acceptable way of solving your political differences. The First World War on the Western Front becomes the definition of the awfulness of war. In the East, on the other hand, it is a beginning because new states emerge.
That sense of upheaval gave the Paris Peace Conference a heady feel. It was modeled on the Congress of Vienna, which marked the end of the Napoleonic Wars a century before. But the issues in Paris were far more complex. Historian Zara Steiner says people poured into the French capital to petition the world leaders.
You had all the hotels being besieged by Arabs, by Jews, by Greeks, by Bulgarians, by Macedonians. I mean, they really couldn't plan for this kind of peace.
So the peacemakers sometimes made hasty and arbitrary decisions. Over time, the conference has become known for the hubris with which statesmen carved up empires and created new countries. Former U.S. diplomat Peter Galbraith has witnessed the consequences of those decisions in the Balkans and the Middle East.
If you're going to engage in that kind of war-ending scenario, you really need to know what you're doing.
His favorite horror story from that time concerns the British diplomat Harold Nicholson. Galbraith says Nicholson was sitting with the British, French, and Italian heads of state one day.
And they were drawing the line on a map of Anatolia between Turks and Greeks. And there they are drawing the boundary. And Nicholson looks at the map and realizes that they have confused a topographic map for an ethnographic map. And they think that the brown are the Turks and the green are the Greeks, when in fact the brown is the mountains and the green are the valleys.
Nicholson spoke up and averted that particular disaster, but it wasn't enough to avert war between Turkey and Greece in the years to come. In fact, wars have erupted in many of the places the peacemakers thought they were sorting out once and for all. The conference was incredibly ambitious, says Margaret McMillan.
I don't think we will ever again get so many powerful people sitting in one place for so long. You know, Woodrow Wilson, the American president, with one brief month when he dashed back to the United States, was out of the United States for 6 months. I mean, he left at the beginning of December 1918. He didn't come home till the middle of July 1919. I mean, can you imagine today an American president doing that?
Wilson's idealistic foreign policy was a central feature of the conference. His ideas about self-determination and his proposal for a League of Nations promised a new way forward. But his words also complicated things, sending out mixed messages. The confusion over Wilson's position began in the last year of the war. In the spring of 1918, the Germans launched a last-ditch offensive on the Western Front. They gained territory, but by the summer the Allies counterattacked and broke through the German lines. The German army was forced to retreat. It was in bad shape, running out of men and running out of supplies. To make matters worse, its allies were dropping out of the war. At the same time, fresh American troops were pouring in. In late September, the Germans began asking for peace. But instead of speaking to the British and the French, they approached the Americans, thinking they would take a softer line.
And I think there was misunderstanding on both sides. The Germans were led to believe that they were being offered peace terms on a Wilsonian basis, on a number of statements he'd made about a peace without retributions, a peace without revenge, a peace that would treat everyone fairly.
It wasn't realistic, McMillan says, and it contributed to a feeling that Germany had been promised a peace in which it wasn't going to lose much. That didn't turn out to be true. In October 1918, while the armies were still fighting, a series of letters passed back and forth between Wilson and the Germans. The Germans were negotiating for an armistice, a truce in effect, that would lead to peace talks. But Wilson and his allies wanted Germany disarmed, and they used the armistice to impose a defeat.
What actually happened in the end is the Germans sent an emissary in a very old-fashioned way, bearing a white flag, and a car went through the lines, and it came to Marshal Foch in the Allied headquarters in Compiègne, and in his railway carriage, the armistice was signed. If you look at the terms of that armistice, it's really a defeat. The Germans basically gave up all their heavy equipment. They gave up all their tanks, their field artillery, their machine guns. They'd already lost their fleet.
The armistice went into effect on November 11th. What soldiers remembered was the silence as artillery finally stopped firing. The war was over, at least for the moment. But if it was a defeat for the Germans, it was an ambiguous defeat. The final peace treaty was still months away, and this wasn't the sort of ending the men who led the fighting were expecting.
generals in some ways still thought in terms of decisive battlefield success. They still thought that all this fighting was going to lead to the moment when there would be the breakthrough, there would be the moment when Allied troops ended up in Germany, and it didn't happen. And yet the war was over. They grappled to put a shape on this.
In that sense, the end of the First World War stands in sharp contrast to the end of the Second World War. In 1945, there was no question but that Germany was defeated. It was occupied. Troops came in from both east and west. Every German citizen could see and feel the defeat. But after World War I, Germany's future was still open. Zahra Steiner says the German question loomed over everything else at the Paris talks.
The fact is that Germany was not destroyed. And this makes it impossible to ignore Germany in any way. She is the central figure at the peace conference, if you want, because it is how you are going to treat Germany which is going to determine whether the peace will keep or whether the peace will shatter.
But the peacemakers disagreed on how to treat Germany. They agreed Germany should be made to pay reparations, but squabbled over the size and share. They agreed Germany's borders needed to shrink, but disagreed on where and why. They had to decide how to control its army and whether to try the Kaiser for war crimes. It took months. It took so long, in fact, that once the great powers had agreed among themselves, they didn't dare open the debate up all over again with Germany, according to Margaret Macmillan.
They simply said, look, with great difficulty and great cost, we've put together these terms. We've got to just give them to the Germans and tell them more or less take it or leave it. And so the Germans, who in the meantime had been preparing for the old-style full negotiations and had crates of material, arrived in Paris with all their boxes and all their positions already prepared and found they weren't going to negotiate.
The Germans were humiliated. And so the Paris Peace Conference turned into something different from what many had envisioned. Hugh Strawn says the end of the First World War was paradoxical in that sense. He says until then, the Napoleonic Wars were the model. A short, decisive campaign, battlefield success, and then a peace settlement.
In the First World War, that isn't how things go. There isn't a decisive battlefield success. We can't simply say, as in 1815, there's the Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon is defeated, he goes into exile, there is a new regime in France, and a new international order is established, which lasts till 1914. What instead we have is a much messier conclusion, no clear decisive battlefield success, and yet we have a series of peace settlements which create a new world order and which dictate a peace to Germany as though it had been defeated on the battlefield.
But of course, the end of World War I didn't bring peace for long. There's been much debate over the years about whether the harsh terms of the Treaty of Versailles led to the Second World War. The historians interviewed here refute the idea. It's too simplistic, they say. Certainly times were tough, and certainly the bitterness Germans felt about the terms was easily manipulated for propaganda purposes. But they reject drawing a straight line between Versailles and World War II. Hugh Strawn says there's a lesson in Versailles nonetheless, how not to treat a defeated foe.
We have now come away from that, saying if we're in that situation in the future, we must recognize the aspirations of both sides. There needs to be a dialogue. Versailles, from that point of view, is seen as a warning that you can't have a peace that treats the defeated power as Versailles seems to treat it if you want it to be a lasting solution.
And if you're not careful, the losing side will manufacture victory out of defeat. It turns out concepts such as victory and defeat are oddly mutable, especially when it comes to memory.
Hello, hello. Field artillery?
Yes, sir.
Captain Newman here. Put down to Captain Fraser.
In London, at the Imperial War Museum, you can walk through a simulation of life in the trenches. Terry Charman is a historian at the museum. He says the way the war is remembered in Britain has led to a perception not of victory, but of defeat.
You know, it is the suffering, the portrayal of trench warfare, the war poets, Sassoon, Owen especially, that somehow, you know, Britain lost the First World War, and of course people dwell so much on the enormous casualty figures. So what is interesting, I think, is the fact that we did win the First World War.
The war ended 90 years ago, but certain places will forever be defined by it. This is the Belgian town of Ypres on the Western Front. The war is still everywhere here. The countryside is saturated with graves. The shop windows display artifacts. A museum on the war occupies the old market hall in the center of town. At 8 o'clock in the evening, traffic comes to a standstill at the city's Menin Gate. Buglers play what's known as the last post in remembrance of the dead, not just once in a while, but every single night. Here, too, there's a sense that loss rather than victory is what pervades. It turns out the end of the First World War holds more than one paradox, with consequences we still struggle to understand today. For The World, I'm Jeb Sharp, Ypres, Belgium.
Tomorrow, in our series, How Wars End, we look back at the first Gulf War. Summertime, you roll the windows down, and it is time to crank up the tunes. Let's see what we got. You know, it's not the same as it was, Harry Styles, pretty catchy. I love Lizzo. Aha, Me Porto Bonito by Bad Bunny. The rapper and reggaeton star from Puerto Rico, dude's got not one, not two, but 10 songs on the Billboard Hot 100 right now, and they are completely in Spanish. There was a time, not that long ago, when this many Spanish language songs on the charts just was not on the radar. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
I didn't pay much attention to pop music back in the 90s because I was cool like that. But you have to be living under a rock not to know Ricky Martin and Livin' La Vida Loca. Upside, inside out, Livin' La Vida Loca, she'll push and it's been like 20 down. Years and I livin' still remember the lyrics. Loca. Her lips are devil red and the skin's a color mocha. Livin' La Vida Loca sold over 20 million albums worldwide. It propelled Ricky Martin to superstardom, it felt like, overnight. But actually, Ricky Martin was already a superstar in Latin America.
Ricky Martin was huge. He sold stadiums. Everybody knew Ricky Martin.
This is Leila Cobo. She's VP of Latin Music at Billboard and author of Decoding Despacito, an oral history of Latin music's greatest hits. When Cobo was researching her book, she spoke to Tommy Mottola. He was the head of Sony Music at the time and the one who would take Ricky Martin's career to the next level.
Tommy Mottola told me that one of the reasons he signed him is because somebody showed him a video of Ricky in Buenos Aires. And it was literally, I think, 100,000 people listening to this guy.
Señoras y señores, amigas y amigos. Ricky, Martin!
And they said, oh my God, can we replicate that? Can we replicate that elsewhere?
Tommy Mottola offered Ricky Martin the chance to do an album in English. It had to be in English if he wanted to be a crossover success.
Mainstream radio was not going to play you if you sang in Spanish. It had happened, but very sporadically. It was something very rare. You know, you had...
La Bamba.
Macarena. You know, you had like these little glimmers, but you didn't have careers in Spanish.
Today, things are different. There's J Balvin. Rosalía. Lo que pasó, a ti te lo cuento. No creas que no dolió. And Bad Bunny.
Bad Bunny is I would say, one of the top three artists in the world. And right now he has the top-selling tour in the planet.
Bad Bunny only sings in Spanish. And he told Trevor Noah on The Daily Show last year that it's not political or anything.
I'm Latino.
Yeah.
I'm Puerto Rican. Yo soy de Puerto Rico.
Uh-huh.
Why I have to change? You know, this is who I am. This is my music. This is my culture. If you don't like it, don't listen to me. If you like it, you know.
How is this possible now when it wasn't, say, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago? One factor was Zumba.
Six, seven, go. One, two.
I'm completely serious.
Five, six.
Zumba was a very early workout program that licensed Latin music.
The way it works is that Zumba Corporate puts together playlists and choreographies for the different songs, and then they offer that to all their Zumba instructors around the world.
And so you're a Zumba instructor in India or in Japan, and you put a Daddy Yankee song, and everybody suddenly listens to Daddy Yankee for the first time.
Another factor, the bigger factor, is streaming. People in Latin America listen to more music than people anywhere in the world, according to multiple music industry studies. They used to do most of that listening on the radio. Now they do it on streaming platforms. Mexico and Brazil are among Spotify's top four markets by volume of streams.
There's this cliche that Latin people like to dance and listen to music. It's not a cliche, it's true. Latin people like to dance and listen to music.
So here's an example of how Spotify pushes Spanish language music across the globe. The song Tutu by Camilo. So it's racking up the streams. The people at Spotify are looking at the numbers and they're like, what is this song? People are listening to it a lot. And so they put it on their Viva Latino playlist, which has 10 million subscribers. So now this song is on the global charts.
And then it kind of feeds on itself and it snowballs from there. It's important to say that none of these trends come from one day to the next. You didn't just get Zumba and you didn't just get a lot of Spanish language music being streamed on Spotify. It's a whole shift that's been happening for two decades.
It started with people like Ricky Martin and Shakira. And then you get Zumba, and then you get YouTube and streaming, and then you get a block of countries that didn't have cell phones and internet before, and now they do, and then you get a new kind of Latin explosion. Not the kind from the 90s that booms and then fizzles, but one that's here to stay. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We made you a Spotify playlist that features a bunch of these Latin hits as well as other global songs of the summer. Check out our Twitter feed for a link. We are at The World. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.